You're listening to the Monocle Weekly, first broadcast on the 4th of May 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to episode 252 of the Monocle Weekly with me, Tom Edwards, and Andrew Tuck.
Coming up in today's show.
There is no time limit to anything. When you look good, you look good.
Senior fashion, ladies and gentlemen. We'll sit down with fashion blogger and now documentary film producer, Ari Seth Cohen, who's got a film out about his favourite New York fashionistas, all women's style and age.
And we speak with an Iranian photographer trying to revive the collective memory of the revolution by reenacting some infamous murder scenes.
Plus, would you be crazy enough to travel the world flight free? We'll talk to slow traveller Ed Gillespie, who's done just that and has come back to tell his tale.
All that, plus some music as well, right here on the Monocle Weekly with me, Tom Edwards, and Andrew Tuck. Andrew Tuck, what a week it's been here at Midori House. Slightly quieter than its predecessor week, which was fairly manic, but busy nonetheless.
Yes, very busy. We didn't finish an issue this week, but we've got 10 days to go until book two goes to the publishers. There's a bit of to and fro then, but then it's going to be published. It comes out in August. So that's been kind of concentrating minds, I might say.
That's the polite expression for it. But this book, are you as excited as you were for the first issue? You still got the same level of intensity, the preparation.
Of course, but the funny thing is, you don't quite know what it looks like until quite near the end, until all the pages are assembled. Because you keep on seeing kind of chapters and spreads and layouts, and then it's only when you finally begin, as we've just been doing this week, really assemble it all into a nice a giant pack, and you can flick through it. You begin to get some sense of, I think it's a nice piece. It's all about the world of work. So it's encouraging people to go out and start a business. But I must say, I'm very much looking forward to Ari Seth Cohen. He's got style
Absolutely.
Tips for the older person.
Andrew, you're not the older generation.
I know that.
Not quite
I've seen,
yet.
I've seen the age group. The age group. When you see those forms, when you what age group you're in, some of them are actually very worrying now.
Surely not.
It's like, at the end of it, is you're in a coffin at the end of the one I'm in.
No one would believe
it's
it,
perplexing.
Andrew. If people meet with you, I'm sure they would never.
But there's a limit to how many monkeys I can catch. Give me your glands. I need them.
Oh, dear. There's still so much future ahead of you, Andrew Tuck.
Thank you. You're saying all the nice things.
Well, I try my best. But maybe we should begin today's show by talking to someone else who has an understanding of the future, a haunting ability to predict what happens in the
Mr. Crystal Balls himself.
It's Daniel Jacopelli. It is time indeed to look ahead, the news look ahead. Andrew, once again, I'm on this side of the mic. Here in the studio at Midori House, I can't look ahead.
No, we've got little Danny.
Little?
It's a term of endearment, I think.
I think you're about the same height as me, actually.
Big Tom.
I think maybe...
Big Tuck.
Maybe you're a centimetre even shorter than me.
I'm 5'9 and a half.
And a half is important.
Maybe three quarters now.
That is actually not true.
I don't know
true.
What that is. That's quite true. I'm not exaggerating. That's not a lot to exaggerate.
I claim 5'9", and I think I'm probably 5'9". And Steve Bloomfield says he's 6'2". I don't know. That's... And that's not true. So I know that you come somewhere below the 5'9".
Well, it's the genius in the head that counts, gentlemen.
I think it's the Cuban heels.
Do we want to talk
also
about the news?
Because you wear your fedora always at work, so it's
confusing. Fedora. That's my hair, Tom. That's my hair.
Anyway, we're going to look ahead.
Should we go to South Africa?
Please.
Let's start there. Yeah, why not?
We'll start serious, not chronologically, because, so the general election is planned in South Africa on the 7th. Jacob Zuma and the ANC, they're widely expected to win. They've been in power for a couple decades now. obviously, there's some controversy too, but lots of people are looking forward to it. I mean, 2 decades in power, the ANC.
And it's extraordinary, isn't it? Because even just a few months ago, people were talking about pressure that had been brought to bear on the ANC. People were losing patience with what they saw as a corrupt administration. And it seemed as if it would be untenable for them to continue in power. But now it looks like they're going to win, not only that, but to win very comfortably.
A comfortable majority, they're saying,
It's intriguing.
Why is that? Do you think that none of the criticism sticks? I know that Helen Ziller is she's one of the speakers for the Democratic Alliance, the kind of opposition. Yeah, and they're all kind of good, credible, politicians. But I guess what's the opposition is always seen as a bit kind of middle class and perhaps associated with the kind of the white people who used to kind of run South Africa, no matter how much they change.
Yeah, there's a lot of baggage, I think, still associated with that, and it's quite hard to shift. Also, I think they get into a situation where if you have a country where there's a general distrust of politicians, they kind of think, well, better the devil you know, almost. And so it's not about kicking out a particular party. It's just about a general sort of apathy with the ruling class. And then they'll say, well, but the ANC is still the best bet of a of a sort of maybe a fairly unappealing playing field.
Well, I'm sure we'll be covering the election in great deal.
So also next week, Shinzo Abe, the Prime Minister of Japan, he'll be in France. He's on a six-nation European tour for 9 days. But on the 4th, I believe, 4th to the 6th, he'll be in Paris. He's going to visit the Louvre. He's going to see Hollande, and he's going to do a bunch of French kind of things.
It's intriguing because obviously Obama's been in Japan fairly recently, and
sure.
One still kind of feels that the most important sort of foreign policy relationship that Japan has is still probably with the US. But is this just a bit of political niceties, sort of pressing the flesh, or do you think that actually that there is a great deal for Europe and Japan to work together on?
Well, there might be. I mean, he's in Japan, rather he's in Europe to get across a lot of security and economic deals and trade deals, security partnerships. But, these things, I mean, we always cover them all the time. Sometimes things happen out of them, but for the vast majority of time, it's kind of just handshakes and, backslaps.
But I guess he'll be keen to find out, what the Europeans feel, about China and the aggression between China and Japan. Mm-hmm. Out in the East and the Pacific. And also, I think following on what's happening with Russia, you realise that one end of Russia sits Japan, at the other end sits Europe, and both at the moment are probably concerned about things going on in Ukraine as well.
Mm. Let's move to Brussels now. Tom, I know that you love seafood.
I do indeed, Danny.
The world's largest seafood expo. Yeah, it's actually called Seafood Expo, is in Brussels next week. 170 countries, 1,600 exhibitors. It sounds absolutely delicious.
You're not mentioning this just for the halibut, are you, Danny?
Oh. Tom, I knew something like that was coming.
That was very good. Do we know what they're going to be serving up? Is it just like it's about eating the stuff, I presume?
It's everything, actually. It's both the selling and it's the processing. So it's actually been changed. It used to be called the European Seafood Expo. Now it's called Seafood Expo Global and Seafood Processing Global. So I assume there's a lot of kind of logistical stuff involved. But involved is fresh, frozen, live, and all other types of seafood.
Sounds like a pretty exciting place.
Oh, look at you. You know your fish puns.
Do you have any travel puns? Because in Dubai is also the Arabian travel market.
I don't think we're going to make puns about the Arabians. that would go down badly.
Well, it's on the 5th to the 8th. It's one of the world's biggest travel events. 2,500 exhibitors.
That's not much of a kind of a tagline. One of the world's biggest travel events.
Well, certainly the Middle East's biggest one.
Andrew, they've got 66 national pavilions.
Yeah, exactly. 2,500 exhibitors. That's a lot of exhibitors. And it's in Dubai. Probably lovely.
Well, it is interesting, actually, isn't it? If you think about these locations as just purely tourist destinations. I mean, I guess a few years ago, they were still, stopovers. People were going for business. People head there for weekends and I don't know. It's quite
I've been
intriguing.
To that event.
Which
have
one?
You really?
Yeah. I went a few years ago. We happened to be there.
At the Arabian Travel Market?
Yeah, and I popped along.
Oh, okay.
It was good.
It was good? Okay, well, there we go.
Is it a fun day out?
Well,
was it more educational?
I was trying to have a chat with the people on the Iran stand. And they weren't having it. They gave me a badge, told me to come back later.
What did the badge say?
It was like, Tehran is cool or something. But
Oh, I see.
But anyway, they weren't very friendly.
I would check for a bugging device. there's two kind of Let's end on some fun things.
I think that was quite fun already.
International
Fish Conference.
Do you not want to hear the other things I have?
Yeah, go on.
It's World Laughter Day on the 4th.
Ha 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 ha. I joined in.
It's based around yoga. I guess it's not really that exciting. But you know what? More fun than that is it's Hedgehog Awareness Week.
He just cannot say the word, can he?
How do you say it?
Hedgehog. You're doing it like you're going out on a giant boar hunt. Have you seen that hedgehog?
Hedgehog.
But it's not. It's a hedgehog.
Hedgehog.
Is it a cute little thing? Do you have hedgehogs in America?
Of course we have hedgehogs in America. I thought they were an indigenous species until you made fun of me.
No, they're everywhere.
They're not. I don't think they made it to Ireland.
Is that right?
I think that you will find that Ireland is free of snakes and hedgehogs.
That's St. Patrick.
That is extraordinary.
Because their little feet, they tried the swim, couldn't make it.
They couldn't make it.
They were washed out of sea and landed up in
the bottom of the
Irish
Sea, hundreds of little tiny hedgehog.
Well, this is run by the British Hedgehog.
They tried a rowboat.
Preservation Society.
Well, they are endangered hedgehogs.
There we go.
I always remember one of the things that's very dangerous for them is that, you know, they'll be, what is it, roosting or whatever they do? Hibernating,
yeah.
Not roosting.
Roosting up in a tree.
Hedgehogs hibernate.
Yeah. And they like to go in sort of piles of leaves and this kind of thing. And quite often people will have a bonfire and they'll be just, it's kind of like it'll turn into an impromptu hedgehog funeral pyre. Yeah.
Well, this year the event is focused on gardeners.
Hog roast.
It would be a hog roast.
They encourage you to do simple things like moving piles of rubbish to a new site, having netting, to the garden.
We did that with your desk the other day. Maybe you'll find one nesting on the other end of your desk now.
So it's Hedgehog Awareness Week, ladies and gentlemen.
I think people need to be aware of hedgehogs.
I love a hedgehog.
Danny, thank you very much for that. A very informative roundup of the week ahead.
My pleasure.
Our first guest this week is something of a trendsetter, someone who shed an entirely new light on the art of fashion blogging. I'm talking about Ari Seth Cohen, of course, the man behind one of the most visited fashion blogs in the world, a website exclusively devoted to senior fashion.
Advanced Style captures the boldest and most creative looks of those in their vintage years. At first, only with photographs, but now there's a documentary too. Advanced Style, the film, premiered at the Hot Docs Festival in Toronto and is coming to the UK. So what do we need to know about those fashionable seniors? Well, Ari is here at Midori House to tell us more about his documentary. But before we go any further, let's listen to some of the characters in the film.
I never wanted to look young. I wanted to look great.
We are here. We are elders. We are still attractive, still, you know, fashionable. And we are here to make our statement.
There is no time limit to anything. When you look good, you look good.
Well, it's an amazing documentary and a joy to watch. But tell us how it all began for you, this documenting of senior style.
Sure. I grew up with two wonderful grandmothers, and they were my best friends. So I've always kind of had an affinity and been drawn to older people. And then I moved to New York in 2008, and I started approaching the city through, I guess, meeting these older people on the street and hearing their stories. And then I started the blog and then made the book. But in that process, I met the director of the film, Lina Plioplite, and she asked me if she could make videos of the women that I was photographing. And so we started to get deeper insight into their lives and really realizing that style was a reflection of like the vitality and creativity that they put into their everyday lives. And so it's been a journey, and the women are really incredible and excited, and they're all, five of them are coming to London for the premiere.
I was just going to say, because the women are quite amazing that they let you go beyond. There's lots of fashion blogs, of course, that shoot people on the streets, and we've seen those again and again, which are great, but these women let you go into their homes, and they let you go into the hospital with them in all sorts of situations. You've kind of got to know them.
Yeah, because I started this as a personal project, I wanted to connect with older people. My grandmother had passed away, and so this was a chance for me to kind of meet her contemporaries who were living in New York. She went to Columbia University, and I knew they probably had similar experiences to her. The first person who really allowed me into her home, you know, I started this on the street photographing women, was she's in the film. Her name is Deborah Rapoport, and I was working at a museum at the time, and I handed her my card, and I said, I take pictures of older women. And she said, how do you know that I'm old? And she had pink hair. She was really wonderful. And she gave me her card. She goes, come over. I'll make you tea. I'll dress. I'll undress. I'll do whatever you want. So I was a little bit scared. I came over. We had a great time, fully clothed, of course. And I introduced her to Lina, and we made our first video of Deborah. And so then I started approaching people on the street more, and I think they became more comfortable with me. And I think because older people are often ignored and made to feel invisible, the fact that I'm approaching them and asking them to tell their stories and asking them to pose in front of the camera, they're really willing to share their lives, and they want that opportunity because they don't generally have that with people overlooking older people.
I just wonder, you mentioned there that it's fundamentally a kind of it started as a social project, and it still retains that. And you can see in the film and on the blog that you have those relationships. Does it work the other way? Do you find that people sort of approaching you and saying, hey, I want to feature, right? I want to be a part of this.
That's happened in the last few years. Facebook messages from older women and emails and tweets and sometimes on the street as well, which makes my job easier. So and a lot of times it's very sweet because grandchildren or daughters or sons of older people will email me and say, you have to photograph my grandmother. And so while I generally, you know, find all the people that I photograph on the street because I like it to be really organic, if I happen to be in a city that doesn't have that pedestrian culture, it's very helpful for someone to say, you have to photograph this man or woman, or you have to interview this person.
A couple of things struck me about seeing the women. First thing was that actually nearly none of their looks seem to be down to the surgeon's knife.
Yes, I try to photograph women who really embrace their age, who celebrate their age, who feel good about themselves. And so my own stance is like, do whatever you want to do to make yourself feel good about yourself. But, you know, I want to have a certain image of aging that, you know, these women like being old. and I don't think they mind their wrinkles, their gray hair. And that's what I'm drawn to on the street. I see someone with gray hair and I run to them. So.
And that great quote, which I think we heard there in the clip, which is, you know, I never wanted to look young. I wanted to look great. And that could be the title of the film, because these women, it's not just that they kind of have maybe a bit of genetics on their side, or that they have, you know, a nice way of dressing. They're really, really dressing. They've got every hat going. They've got every bit of jewelry in the store.
It's about, you know, really their spirit and their sense of play and their sense of fun. They've been dressing up since they were young. And so I think this has just developed over time and grown stronger, and they're bolder and they don't care what anyone thinks. And thank you for that amazing introduction, calling me a trendsetter, because it's funny, like, these women don't believe in trends at all. You know, one of the women who actually didn't make it into the film, but she was like, if someone says for me to buy this, I say, put it down, because they have their own unique sense of style. And for them, that is a form of self-expression.
I wanted to ask you something that sort of reflects upon that, which is in the film we see that some of these women going to kind of meet the new generation, going to schools and talking to young women, mm-hmm. much, much younger, so maybe even three generations younger. How did you feel about those meetings? And were you surprised by the reaction, I guess, of some of these young kids meeting these women? Did their response fit with what you imagined?
So when I started this project, I was viewing these younger women and my friends in New York City who were dressing in vintage and kind of reflecting the fashion of older women. It was sort of a trend to, you know, wear vintage and use Chanel bag. And so I knew that if I showed these incredible women on a blog, that hopefully younger women would respond to them and then be less fearful of getting older. So I always knew that they would take away something from them. I mean, everywhere they go, young women come up to them and say, I can't wait to get older. I can't wait to look like you, which is, I think, a huge shift, because when I first started the project, people were emailing me saying, at 30 years old, I got my first gray hair and I'm worried about getting older. And then now I'm getting emails saying, I can't wait to get older, which is incredibly gratifying. And to hear that, you know, we have such a stigma against aging. And then you see these women who are having fun and now... in their 80s and 90s, becoming models and running around the world and still being joyful, you realize that fun and creativity and all these things don't end at a certain age.
Can I just ask about that idea about stigma you mentioned? Do you still see the sort of vestiges of that at times? Do you still get some correspondence or people approaching you saying, you know, I don't really think this is right? Do you get any sort of negative response, or do people just, are they really struck by the warmth with which it's all done and it really engages them?
Oh, against the blogger aging in general, obviously there's a huge stigma against aging. I think that there are, like, when it comes to working with people, I think there is a lot of fear with advertising and companies to work with older people. There's still this fear in ageism in fashion and in so many other industries. So hopefully that will change, and hopefully the film will be a part of that. Not everyone can love what you do as well. And I photograph women who are very expressive and have, you know, some of them are super eccentric, but it's not like a guidebook of this is how you should look. It's more a form of showing women who feel really good about themselves and show that you don't have to feel or be invisible no matter. Once you hit a certain age.
I love the fact that many of these women, they look so coquettish once you suddenly turn the camera on them. And it's an interesting time. There's been a story this week, Christy Turlington, I think, was saying that she loves every minute of getting older. She doesn't regret losing her looks at all. But I wanted to ask you also, there's an arc to the film and there's some tragedy along the way. Mm-hmm. There's an interesting point when we come to where somebody you know and have been documenting, she actually dies at a fashion show aged 95. Could you just tell us maybe a little bit about her?
Oh, yeah. So obviously this is inevitable in what I do, that something that I have to deal with. And I form these very strong bonds with these incredible women. And Zelda Kaplan, she's was kind of a nightclub fixture in New York, always dancing. She used to hang out with like Snoop Dogg and Paris Hilton in her 80s and 90s. This incredible woman who was actually became known for her style, everything. She had all her clothes made from fabric she had collected in Africa. So she had a very unique look. She was incredibly brilliant, very political, and all these trips around the world were very political. But she liked to celebrate life and she loved dancing. And so when we met her, it was at a time where she was declining. And so in the film, it kind of shows our initial meetings with her. And then in the front row of Fashion Week, she passed away. And in a way, it continues that celebration of life. It's better than going.
She upstaged everyone right to the last minute.
She did. She was really incredible.
You mentioned that she's quite a political character. Do you think there's a broader political point maybe to take from the movie and from your work generally, I guess, about, you mentioned about older people being, you know, they're invisible to society, they're not listened to. I mean, is that one hope that you have more broadly, that perhaps not just in terms of these, you know, very particular sort of type of women, you know, in New York City or in the big cities around the world, but more generally in society, that people may actually reflect that these people have a voice and they actually have a lot of incredible insights that people should listen to?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I think that the film is very fun, and then there's these deep, subtle moments that you come back saying, hopefully changing your philosophy on getting older. And my blog and book kind of have that same kind of fun, uplifting, positive message. And I think that I focus on that because there's so much of the other stuff when it comes to aging. You already know the bad things that happen. You already know the decline. You already know the sickness. Every commercial is about medication. And so all these things are already out there. So I'm kind of projecting a alternative view of aging in what I do. My focus is not on changing the way that women dress around the world. It's just changing attitudes towards aging. And I would love to, I mean, it was my dream as a little kid to open up a nursing home. So that's actually a project that I'm working on now. It's just like writing down ideas about, you know, how we could change healthcare and senior living homes in America. So it definitely extends beyond just the physical. And I do hope people take away something from this movie and really, you know, create relationships with older people, look at aging in a different way. The most incredible thing that's happened is people that I know, friends of friends, will now, who never looked at older people, will look at them on the street and say, I was just here and I saw this incredible woman on the street. So it definitely does bring a visibility to the aging population.
Ari, perhaps finally you could tell us, after you've met all these extraordinary women, what do you think is the connecting dot that's kept them the way they are?
They all have this incredible passion in their lives, and something, whether it's dressing up or relationships with their family, or it's something inside them that keeps them going. Ilona Roy Smithkin, she's 94, she's in the film. Every day she wakes up, she does her leg lifts, she stretches, she makes sure. She lives in a 3-floor walk-up. I'm out of breath walking up there, and she does it every day. She makes sure she goes outside. They have this will to keep going, to keep expressing themselves. And each one of them has this like incredible vitality. And if you want to meet them, they're going to be, five of the women from the film are going to be here. We're doing screenings on this week, and then the film comes out May 9th. So go to advancedstylefilm.com, and you can meet the ladies in person in London.
It's a quality plug on which to end. But yeah, Advanced Style is the film. Ari Seth-Cohen, the man behind all of it, thank you very much for coming to tell us all about it here on The Weekly.
Thank you so much.
Andrew, I'd like to play some music now. Do you agree with that as the strategy as we move forward?
And I know what's coming up. These are two proper Monocle 24 favourites.
Indeed they are. Regular listeners will not be surprised to hear from Royksopp and Robin, but together, Andrew.
I know, amazing.
It's going to really surprise people. This is their collaboration, a brand new track. It's called Do It Again.
That was Royksopp and Robin with Do It Again.
The Monocle app has all the details of what's coming up on Monocle 24 and offers you the chance to catch up on shows you might have missed. You can download programs to your mobile or tablet to listen offline and set reminders of all your favorites. It also has one-tap access to the latest news reports from our editors and correspondents around the world. The 2525 is Monocle's insider guide to the world's premier resort and business cities. The app features recommendations for the best hotels, restaurants, and retail opportunities, along with GPS directions, ensuring Monocle is your one-stop guide to city hopping. You can even give us feedback on personal favorites you've discovered on your travels. The Monocolumn is Instapaper supported and available to read on your mobile, fully integrated to fit any size and screen. The Monocle app is available through iTunes and at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
You're listening to The Monocle Weekly with me, Tom Edwards, and Andrew Tuck. It all started during the Green Revolution in Iran. Tehran photographer Azadeh Akhlaqi was so shocked by the images of the death of a protester, Nader Agha Sultan, that she started wondering what other visual traces of Iran's past were available to the public. She decided to reproduce some of Iran's most infamous death scenes from the time long before camera phones, before her own lens.
The result is an arresting series of death scenes. There's the poet who died after swerving a car to avoid a school bus, the leftist intellectual whose execution was never solved, or the gold medal wrestler who also died in mysterious circumstances. In recreating these scenes, Akhlaqi provides us with her own version of history, an eyewitness account of sorts. So why and how? Well, to discuss this further, we're on the line now with the photographer herself. Welcome to the show, Azadeh. So let's ask that question first of all. Why did you decide to depict these particular scenes?
Well, it began with a political shock in the aftermath of post-election uprisings in Iran in 2009, as well as the Arab Spring. And during those days, I started to think about the revival of history. You know, we read about our historical heroes in books, and sometimes come across their vague pictures like black and white photos or the fast-moving, unclear footages. But in all those representations, they are still a part of the past and are bound to remain so. So it was, you know, there is a gap between us, a silence hard to break, because we consider them part of the history. And this is the reason that often an unspoken sorrow, which we all hold in silence, makes our connection to them.
Azadeh, I wanted to ask you about the pictures themselves, because they're very grand in scale. They have an extraordinary scope, both in terms of the narrative they capture and visually. They almost have quite a sort of painterly quality. Some of them even sort of remind me of those macabre scenes that you'd see in a painting by Velázquez, things like that. Were you influenced by painted art and painted pictures of history as much as by photographic depictions?
Yeah, it's more the painting and also the literature, you know, the masterpieces of Russian and French writers of 19th century. You know, for instance, I'm very interested in populated settings of like Dostoevsky's The Devils or War and Peace of Tolstoy. And through a careful reading of them, one learns extremely precious lessons as to how to manage a similar situation in photography.
Tell me, some of the events that you've depicted are not from recent times. They date back to the 1920s. There's an amazing picture here from a courtyard depicting something that happened in 1924 when a prominent poet was killed in his own home by assassins. Now, many of these events are perhaps unknown to people in the West, but are they events which you feel that all Iranians can associate with and that are perhaps not the kind of the most political or divisive events, even though they are very tragic?
Well, one of the astonishing consequences of 2009 uprising was that many old political figures and activists or murdered intellectuals and journalists of Iran came into the spotlight after decades. You know, they emerged from the ruins of the history, and even though they died many years ago, their souls kind of took part in the movement, in the green movement we had in Iran. And you could feel their presence out on the streets of Tehran. And I believe rising up for freedom is also an attempt to redeem the oppressed history of your past. And that's why I wanted to include all of them in my project, all the people from different backgrounds, like journalists, poets, writers, sportsmen, intellectuals, and everybody.
Azadeh, I wanted to ask you about the fact that there's so much intriguing work coming out of Iran, particularly by female artists, female photographers. There's obviously a lot of people working in cinematography and in movie making as well, particularly women. Do you think it's that in some respect there's a bit more latitude now for women working in Iran within the arts to deal with some more controversial subjects? Because it seems like pretty extraordinary to people from the West looking in that you have such a scope to depict so many events, be they political in nature, historical, but to have the sort of artistic freedom to do that. Has that surprised you?
Yes, it is surprising actually for me as well. But Iranian women were very active during the Islamic Revolution of 1979. You know, we can see them in my pictures, like in from the picture of 1974 of the guerrilla movements. There is a shot in a house that 11 guerrillas are killed, and that in that picture, you can see half of them are women. So we have this history, basically. And again, during the Green Movement, we saw many women in the streets of Tehran. And also in the art scene, we could see many women here. And, you know, also Iran is a very young country with many young women here who are trying to do something, you know.
And Azadeh, just following on from Tom's point there, have the authorities, you know, have the people who do watch over what happens artistically in Iran had anything to say to you? I know you had an exhibition of these pictures in Tehran that was very successful. That space that you're given as an artist, were you left alone when these pictures were shown?
No, I didn't have any problem for showing my pictures in Tehran. I showed all of them last February in a gallery in Tehran, and we have definitely no problem here with the authorities. Because all the pictures are about the past, about before the revolution, you know.
Well, I wanted to ask you a bit about that, the fact that they depict scenes from the past. Do you think that the works are historic then, or are they contemporary pieces because they were staged and photographed now? Or do you think that they may even have something to contribute for the future in terms of how Iran and Iranian people remember the past and how they consider themselves in the future? Are they historic objects? Are they from the present? Or are they, in some respect, even about the future?
In this project, I kind of indulged myself into even manipulating the history. I didn't even follow the chronological order. And in some of the pictures, you see some elements in the setting that don't belong to that time or place. I put something from the future in some of the pictures. So, they could be contemporary because we have this repetitive death in our history.
And just tell me, the actual making of these photographs, was it a very elaborate process? I'm looking at here a picture from showing something that happened on December the 7th, 1953, when several students were killed at Tehran University. There was a visit by Vice President Richard Nixon, and they had been demonstrating. But there are so many people in the picture, and it's staged over quite a large space. How long does it take you to set these images up?
The research for this project took about 3 years. For the shooting, when I had a group, I had 1 month for pre-production to find all the locations and do makeup tests and costume tests and everything. And then we had 20 days for production. So we had to be very quick. We had like 1 day for shooting each picture. So, and for that picture that you were talking, the student shot, we only had like about 2-3 hours to shoot the whole scene because we were inside a school in Tehran and I had some women without hijab. So we took it very quickly. But we practiced before in the gallery with the actors and everyone.
That was the photographer Azadeh Akhlaghi speaking to us from Tehran. And you can see her work at Somerset House right here in London until the 10th of June.
Up next, we meet an explorer who has decided to travel by any means possible except an aeroplane.
The Monocle subscription package is your year-round entry into the world of Monocle. For £90, you get a year of Monocle in print. And that's 10 magazines, including 2 double issues and our 2 seasonal newspapers, Alpino and Mediterraneo. You'll get access to online archives and an exclusive tote bag designed by our in-house team and made by our friends at Rutote of Japan. Plus, free shipping to wherever you are in the world. And that's all for £90 sterling. Or you can double your fun with our 2-year package for £170. Which comes with 2 bags and our exclusive organiser. So treat yourself, or even a loved one, to a Monocle subscription, available at monocle.com.
It's a green thumbs up from us for Tokyo's leading flower market and auction, where merchants indulge in the business of buying blooms.
The Japanese flower market is the place for perfectionists. Anyone looking for a branch of cherry blossom just before it flowers, or a blemish-free orchid with every flower facing the same way.
Blooms or Bust, a photographic essay on the Ota flower market, now showing in the film section on monocle.com.
You're listening to The Monocle Weekly with me, Tom Edwards, and Andrew Tuck. Now, our faithful listeners will know that there are a few things we enjoy more here at Monocle than aviation, but our next guest is a man who decided to go on an entirely flight-free adventure all around the world, and by doing so, he managed to catch our attention, of course.
Ed Gillespie did pretty much everything else to get around, aboard cargo ships, by camel, hitchhiking, or by hovercraft. And he narrates his travels in a new book, Only Planet, A Flight-Free Adventure Around the World. And he paid us a visit at Midori House a little earlier. He discussed his book and the wonders of flight-free travel with Monocle's Alad John.
So Only Planet is a book that I wrote off the back of a round-the-world trip without flying in 2007-2008. And I went to do the trip because I wanted to rediscover a sense of adventure. By forsaking flight, I thought, by travelling overland and by sea, I'd sort of experience a greater reconnection with the world. And also I do a lot of work on climate change, so I felt sort of vaguely hypocritical, splurging a vast kind of slew of carbon emissions into the atmosphere in order to get my jolly.
It always strikes me as funny when I see news reports of done at the Arctic or something, and it's talking about the effect of climate change, and you thought, well, come on, the carbon emissions that it's taken you and the news crew to fly up there is pretty formidable. Okay, well, let's get into the nuts and bolts of it. You set off from London.
Yeah.
How did you pin down the route? Where did you want to go and why choose it?
This is the interesting thing, because I didn't actually really pin down the route at all. The very first part of the journey was the number 59 bus down Brixton Hill to Waterloo Station. You know, and in those days, I caught the train from Waterloo to Portsmouth, and then I took a ferry to Spain. And then it was overland from there on in. But actually, the only thing I booked in advance before leaving was the Trans-Siberian Express, the railway to cross Russia. Everything else was booked en route. And that was deliberate as well, to allow a sort of flexibility and spontaneity and to be able to make decisions on the hoof.
So why travel around the world, though? I know that you, in tandem with your literary work, you do a lot of work on climate change and sustainability. Is it a fair argument to say perhaps then travelling around the world, even if you are using trains or buses or even walking to an extent, you're adding to the problem to some degree?
Well, it's interesting because I did actually keep a kind of carbon record of the whole trip at the back of the book. And actually, if you look at that, it's about 1.5 tons for the whole trip. So for the 13 months I was on the road, I only emitted 1.5 tons of carbon. And you think about the average UK emissions is around 10 tons a year. So actually, my recommendation to people is to go travelling around the world and save the planet in the process, because your carbon emissions end up being a fraction of what they are at home.
There's a lovely part in the book near the beginning when you're talking about the process of travelling. Well, reminding you of what it's like to actually travel. It was something that occurred to me some time ago. I did a cycle trip, and it was a way of seeing Spain, it was, in fact, and actually knowing that you've trodden the path and you feel like you've actually seen the landscape. But you're right, the short-haul travel misses the point of all of that. You don't feel like you've travelled. You blink and suddenly you're in a completely different country. Does that sound familiar to you?
Yeah, completely. I mean, I think the problem is travel's become very transactional. And it's always about what do I want to get and where I'm going. And actually, the fact that sort of misses the whole point that the journey really is the reward, you know, and there's a fundamental intimacy you get when you travel through a place, you know, when it's the transition of culture, landscape, people, cuisine, all of those things add to the richness of the experience. And also, I think it celebrates what we have in common. You know, when you travel through Europe or even around the world, you realise that the kind of the little differences that accumulate along the way are actually a celebration of the things we all hold in common. Whereas when you fly, it's such a kind of brutal disjunct. It actually emphasises difference and actually makes us feel more disconnected than we actually are.
Are there any particular highlights or adventures that you want to flag up?
Well, crossing the oceans, the Atlantic and the Pacific on cargo ships was an extraordinary experience, you know, just to be in the middle of such a vast expanse of water and realise you're 2,000 miles from land in any direction.
Yeah, there's a great description of them being, I can't remember the name of the ship in particular, but as flexible or as a tower block.
Yeah, exactly. They're not very manoeuvrable.
There you go.
Yeah, you're not going to be... And they go fast enough, some of the big ones, to be able to water ski behind them if you really wanted to have a go. But they, in terms of navigation, you know, they are like steering a block of flats.
But so the cargo ships was a highlight for you, or perhaps the most thrilling?
Not necessarily the most thrilling, but actually very ruminative. You know, it was actually, because we were on the boats for kind of a dozen, 16 days at a time, it was a really wonderful reflection time during the journey to sort of catch up on all the incredible experiences we'd had en route. But for me, actually, the really kind of thrilling stuff was in Mongolia. I mean, it was a place that you have such a kind of amazing image of it in your mind from all the legends of Genghis Khan and all of the kind of the rampaging Mongol hordes. And then you get to this extraordinary country, which is almost empty. You know, it's the size of Western Europe. There's only a population of about 3 or 4 million people. You know, half of them live in Ulaanbaatar. And then there's just this wonderful wilderness of rugged mountains, icy lakes, you know, the Gobi Desert. And it's just extraordinary. And it feels like a world that's relatively untouched by humanity, which is hard to find these days.
I wonder, is it a very lonely experience at times?
Yeah, I mean, it's a relentlessness to it. You know,
how long were you out on the road again?
381 days, so just over 13 months.
Yeah.
You get isolated. You do miss, obviously, your friends and family. But more than that, I think the duration of the trip actually becomes a bit like Prozac. You know, it's actually, you're still having these extraordinary experiences, but the novelty or the edge of them sort of starts to wear off a little bit. And then you realise that actually you've become slightly numbed to these incredible wonders.
So you need to up the ante a bit.
Well, you're either up the ante or you think, actually, you know, there's a mental discipline in this. And also, my recommendation would be to take slightly smaller trips, because I think there's an inevitable kind of brushing off of the edges after so long on the road.
Was it all, forgive the pun, was it all plain sailing?
No.
Like that?
No, I mean, some of our most spectacular cock-ups, I mean, you kind of forget about all the kind of challenges.
It was a rocky road.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a bit bumpy journey. No, but just crossing borders is always the real challenge.
Yeah.
You know, because you forget that there's all these kind of national boundaries, which you usually just fly over in a plane. And then suddenly you've got to navigate your way through them, have the right visas and the right documentation. And, you know, there's all sorts of smuggling checks. And, you know, you can get into all sorts of trouble if your paperwork's out of date. And when we got carted off the train by Chinese border guards because our visa had expired 48 hours beforehand, which we hadn't realised because it had been issued 30 days before. So we hadn't realised it had run out. So we got kind of held at gunpoint, you know, with the Chinese border guard. So they got approval from the Public Security Bureau to let us in. I got taken aside and nearly got done for drug smuggling going into Japan because of some dodgy Vietnamese rolling tobacco, which the customs officer was convinced was marijuana. I would quite like to if it had been marijuana, but it certainly wasn't. You know, so you get into all these kind of skirmishes. I mean, we never got robbed, never got, you know, I mean, the world is a wonderful place and is largely full of benevolent and good people. And I think that's the kind of enduring lesson that comes through.
What are the serious lessons out of this that you want people to learn from your book? I know sustainability is a key issue for you. Was that what you have learned? You mentioned that you think smaller journeys in duration is an important thing to take from it.
Well, I think for me, the kind of the real things that are coming out is, like, you know, the book is called Only Planet for a Reason. It is our one precious home. It is about celebrating the fact that actually by some relatively small shifts in lifestyle choices and the things that we do, we can dramatically transform our impact on the world. But also it's about celebrating the things, I said, the things that we hold in common, the things which we share, and the fact that we are, you know, one species of humans along with millions of other species of fellow travelling animals, plants, and microbes. And we're all part of the same team. And it's actually getting the thrill of that kind of connectedness that I really got from going around the world.
As a man who preaches the good word of sustainability, innovation, and those the big important factors that we should all pay attention to, you travel a lot with your work. Do you hold those principles dear to you? Do you use planes to get around? Do you always go by train if you can?
Oh yeah, so I haven't flown on holiday in a decade, in over a decade now. I have taken one or two flights for work when I've just had no other option. But I always make sure that, you know, there's a kind of a good justification for doing so. But for example, I mean, I've come here to talk to you today straight off a sleeper train from Prague, where I've been running a workshop for a client for the last couple of days. So, you know, and it's not bad. I left there 4 o'clock yesterday afternoon and I was here by 10 o'clock this morning. So, you know, it's not a long journey. I spent 8 of those hours asleep on the train and met all sorts of people and had a few beers along the way.
That was Ed Gillespie, a global slow traveller, whose book Only Travel, A Flight-Free Adventure Around the World, is out on the 1st of June.
Well, that's it for edition 252 of the Monocle Weekly. And damn fine show it was too.
It was pretty good, Andrew. I just wonder, would you tackle global travel purely by land? I could imagine you on board a camel or two along the way.
I've been on a camel.
I don't like them.
They are okay.
Aren't they quite aggressive?
My one was fine. Oh. You get slightly sore backside because they're quite wide, so you have your legs akimbo a bit. And they swerve quite a lot, and they're kind of like, ooh, you're swayed from side to side.
Oh, I always think they've got a bit of a sort of an attitude.
We slept in a camp at night with them, and at night, oh, the smell.
I was going to say, you'll recall my interest in military animals, and camels don't work very well alongside regular cavalry, because apparently horses, they just cannot abide the smell of a camel.
Well, down the back end is not good, I can tell you. Having been parked not far from the rear.
Yeah. Not a place you want to be.
And they don't stop eating all night.
Oh, really?
They're midnight munchers.
Are they?
You just can't trust them.
Are they cud chewers?
Yeah, cud chewers. And then
heavens. Oh. So maybe avoid them. What about other land-based transport you'd be all right with?
Yes, I think all other means of transport I'd be very happy with. Yeah, I don't mind not going by plane. I quite like not going by plane. I like going by train.
Train is that's a quality way to travel. But I don't like those...
Not coach.
No, the old charabanc from the olden days.
I like to be... train is very good. Now, unfortunately, everyone's going to miss the highlight of the show. Danny Ciocapelli fell over when he left the studio.
That was quite extraordinary. It makes me wonder, I mean, what had he been up to last night? Saturday night, maybe he'd been out in the town?
He claimed he missed the door handle.
That was an unconvincing excuse, frankly.
But anyway, he fell over. In fact, he nearly fell on our laps. But anyway, it was entertaining.
That was pretty funny.
Like this show.
Well, every week.
I think we should leave it there. I'm not sure who's going to be here next week. I think I'm around. Maybe you're around. It depends on Rob Bound's love life, whether he's
exactly. And maybe your regular sparring partner, Rob Bound. Who knows?
He's in Berlin.
Maybe a fragrant camel, Andrew.
Yeah, maybe a fragrant camel. Anyway, today's show, it was produced by Daphne Denis, and our studio manager was Claire Urban.
I may not be here, but somebody will be here alongside Andrew Tuck next week. But from me, Tom Edwards.
And me, Andrew Tuck.
It's goodbye.
And cheerio.